Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. Final hour of the 2024 year. We'll finish it out with some excellent best of segments for you. Starting off with Gary Strongberg, who joined Mark back in November. He's a producer and writer, by the way, Gary Strongberg. And ahead of him joining, just ahead of that, was the Jake Paul and Mike Tyson fight. And they reminisced on a time when there was a real fight going on, the Rumble in the Jungle. And, of course, Gary was heavily involved in the music festival that led up to the Rumble in the Jungle. And Mark and him discuss.
So we got a faux fight tonight on Netflix with Jake Paul and Mike Tyson. Man, that was a real fight in 1974. They called it the Rumble in the Jungle, and there was a big concert, a three-day music festival, actually, that took place with the Rumble in the Jungle. And my friend Gary Stromberg is back with us this afternoon because he helped put all that together. There's a new podcast called Rumble, the Soul of 74. Mr. Gary Stromberg, how are you? And by the way, congratulations on the World Championship of the Los Angeles Dodgers, because I know you're a huge Dodgers fan. And look, we gifted you Tommy Edman and Jack Flaherty, so you have to appreciate that from here in St. Louis.
Boy, you sure did. I saw he bought like a $4 million house out here yesterday.
Awesome. I love Tommy Edmonds so much. We miss him dearly. You can have Flaherty,
yeah,
but that's another topic.
I don't know why you let him go.
Well, there's a lot of things we're not really sure of, Gary, when it comes to baseball in St. Louis. But how are you? And congratulations on another podcast, because the last time we talked to you was when you were doing the Stone 72 Tour Across America, yeah, which, by the way, was awesome. I love that.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Wow, it's really nice to be with you. I'm excited, man. Tonight's going to be big time. That fight with Tyson and Jake Paul has got everybody excited, I think. And it's how ironic, it's 50 years, like almost exactly 50 years, that the Rumble in the Jungle took place. You know, that it drew 60,000 people, which is what the fight tonight will draw, and over 1 billion people watched that fight.
You know, Sue and I were talking about this because, look, I was only in 1974, I was 9 years old. But, you know, in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, boxing was so big, we would even listen to it on the radio, Gary.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, boxing really, the 70s was really the golden era, I think, of boxing. There was a number of really big fights.
But you're not really talking about boxing in this podcast. You're talking about everything that happened around that fight in the music festival, yeah, right?
That's correct. Yeah, 74 was a stellar year. I mean, there were a lot of big-time events. Watergate took place in 1974 with Nixon having to resign. And, we had this big festival. The festival took place because the president, the ruler of Zaire, Mobutu, wanted to put Zaire on the map. It was a newly independent country. And so he thought by staging this grand fight, Ali Foreman, that he would call great attention to it. And my friends Stuart Levine and Hugh Masekela came up with the idea of, well, wow, if they're going to do this big fight there, why don't we do a music festival alongside of it? So that was what was put together. And the festival, we got together some of the greatest African-American and African musicians of the time, James Brown, B.B. King, Miriam Makeba, the Spinners, the Pointer Sisters. We had just a great lineup of people that came to Africa for this festival. But unfortunately, Foreman got injured in training for the fight, and the fight was postponed.
Oh, that's why. So that was going to be my question. You walked me in. Because the festival is 3 weeks before the actual fight, right?
We were all in Africa. We were all there waiting for the fight and the festival. They were going to be concurrent. It was going to be the festival, and then the next day was going to be the fight. But because Foreman got injured, the fight was postponed, and we were already there. So nobody wanted to go back home and then come back again. I mean, it's a big trip to go back to Zaire. And there were so many arrangements that had already been previously made, and all the logistics had been, you know, in play. So we all stayed and had the festival 3 weeks before the fight, as you said.
So what were the dynamics? Because obviously you mentioned the ruler of Zaire. He plays a pinnacle point in all of this because he wants to put this on. And then all you guys come from America to try to work with him. But was that a difficult process with a guy that basically is a dictator?
It was totally crazy. It was just silly. I'll give you an example. This stadium held 60,000 people, and we expected that we would be sold out because of the talent. We had 250 American musicians and 250 African musicians for this three-day festival. So all these plans and all this, you know, setting this thing up, and then comes the first night of the festival, and we show up for the festival, and there's hardly anybody in the stands. And what happened was that we learned late, obviously, that nobody would come to an event that wasn't sanctioned by Mobutu. And he had not given us the blessing, his blessing for the event, or at least the public didn't know that he had given us the blessing. So nobody went. They were in dire fear for their lives if they went and did something that Mobutu didn't sanction. So somebody in our group got to Mobutu that night and said, listen, here's the problem. And Mobutu, the next day, publicly sanctioned the event. And the second day, we were totally sold out.
So what happened then on the first day? Did artists still play? And
we played. It just wasn't, there was hardly anybody there. But you couldn't see it. I mean, for the purposes of filming it, there wasn't, you didn't show the audience. But yeah, it was tough playing a festival of this size to a very sparse audience.
What was your specific role in all of that? Were you handling, because you represented, your agency represented a lot of the bands. When we talked about the Stones were with you. But what was the specific role that you had?
I was the PR guy.
Yeah.
I was in charge of taking care of the media for the event. We brought over a number of really wonderful American journalists, Bud Schulberg, Norman Mailer, George Plimpton. These were all guys there to cover the fight, but they also wanted to, cover the festival as well. So I was in charge of a number of really outstanding writers that were there to cover the event.
So I listened. Yeah, I heard the Norman Mailer connection. That's a name from the past for sure. But I was listening to the first part. Gary, I'm on the road here for a couple hours after the show. I'm going to continue to listen to Rumble, the Soul of 74. But I did hear some of it in the setup for it. So explain what the podcast is all about and how it works.
Well, the podcast sets up in context the entire realm of what took place in 1974. This was really, if you watch 60 Minutes, it's very much like a 60 Minutes episode because we give the context of world events in 1974 and the pressures that were on and especially the emergence of black excellence in the United States. It was a critical year for the emerging black power movement and all of the efforts to create awareness of the struggle that black people in America had gone through. So the fight was certainly a representative of a major force in sports, and the music festival was obviously a significant statement in what in the emerging black music scene looked like.
What was the role of Don King in all this? Obviously, he was promoting the fight, right? Did he have nothing to do with the music festival? What can you say?
No, he didn't have anything to do with the music festival.
Okay.
He tried to take credit for it, but
shocking.
Yeah, this
shocking.
Was Don King's first entry into big time fight promotion. It was kind of interesting. There's a segment in one of the episodes in the podcast where the prelude to the Ali Foreman fight was George Foreman fighting who was then the champion, Joe Frazier, in Jamaica in 1973. Frazier had beaten Ali in New York in Madison Square Garden in 1971. And so he was the new champion. George Foreman was coming along. He was undefeated. And he fought and knocked out Joe Frazier in 1973, which was the prelude and which set up the Ali Foreman fight. But the funny thing about that story was Don King was Joe Frazier's promoter. And so he drove to that fight in Jamaica in the limousine with Joe Frazier. And as the fight progressed and it looked like Frazier was getting his ass whipped, if you excuse the expression,
it's all right.
Don King like slid over to the corner of George Foreman. And he left the fight that night in the limo with George Foreman. So he came with the champ and he left with the champ.
That's very interesting. You know, one of the things I've always recommended this movie, and it's been a little bit since I've gone back to watch it, but it was one of the best, I think it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, called When We Were Kings. I'm guessing you saw that, about the Rumble in the Jungle.
Really, the Academy Award.
Yeah, it was really, really a great movie, and I got to go back and watch it again, but obviously that's framed around the same story that you're talking about. One of my favorite stories that you share, I think the first time we met in person, you told me the story. I've had you repeat it on the air, but you got to share the story again. You're on this plane. I can't remember if you're leaving Zaire, James Brown. There's kind of excitement, yes, all sure. kinds of excitement. Gary, you take it from here.
Yes, that's in the podcast as well. So we're flying up a charter flight from New York to Zaire, and it's an 18-hour flight. It's a long flight, and we had 250 musicians packed into this plane. Because it was charter, you could bring all your stuff with you onto the plane. So the plane, all the aisles are packed with instruments. There was musical stuff all over the plane, and it's totally packed. And what had been the first class section was given over to James Brown and his band because he was the headliner. And we're all crammed into the rest of the plane. And we make this long trip to the first leg of the trip was to Rome. So I don't know, like it was 8 hours or something like that to Rome. We get to Rome, everybody's exhausted. They fuel up on the tarmac, and they didn't let us off the plane because we were going to take off as soon as we had refueled. And we're sitting there, everybody's anxious, and our nerves are pretty shot from all this activity. And the pilot comes on the loudspeaker and says, "Listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have a slight problem. We are way overweight on this flight, as you can imagine. And in Rome here, we have a short runway. So we've been told that based on the weight we are carrying, we won't be able to take off unless everybody in the front of the plane moves to the back of the plane." At which point, James Brown stands up and yells, "I'm the star of this MF show, and we're going to take off because I'm here." And when he said that, everybody in the plane was like, went crazy. Bill Withers, who was one of the artists on the plane, was sitting in the back. He just lost it. And I don't know where he got, but he was traveling with a knife, which he pulled out and started up the aisle with, I guess, the intention of killing James Brown. So he had quite a confrontation between the two of them. And James Brown apparently would not move. And so the pilots took off knowing that we were warned that we were overweight, and we were scared to death. They took off because James Brown refused to move to the back of the plane or any of his band.
I love that story so much. I know you've told it a million times, but man, that is just incredible, Gary Stromberg. Rumble and the Soul of 74. Are all the episodes out right now?
No, they're just being released one a week.
Okay.
We're up to episode 6 now, but you can go back and start from the beginning. There's really some wonderful material here. I hate to brag about this, but I have a wonderful production crew that put together just a very exciting episode.
Yeah, it's very good. I'm about three-quarters through the first one. One thing I would say as a compliment to you is, man, it's going to be hard to beat the Stones podcast because that was really good, Gary. I loved every minute of that. Listen, thank you so much for coming on here again. Congratulations to your Dodgers. And we'll catch you up and talk a little horse racing soon. How does that sound?
Yeah, I was just going to say, take care of yourself.
All right, Gary, we'll see you.
It is indeed the Mark Rudin Show on 97.1 FM Talk. A little bit of Elton John to wrap up 2024. You can never go wrong with that. Quick score update for you. Blues up 2-1 after one period of play at the 2024 NHL Winter Classic, being played at Wrigley Field this year. And I didn't even mention I'm wearing my Winter Classic jersey, my Winter Classic beanie. I'm all geared up for it here in studio as we continue on with the best ofs to wrap up 2024. We have a couple more great segments here to wrap up the show. Back in August, Mark was joined by Jennifer Say, who is the founder and CEO of XXXY Athletics, and she was also a producer for Athlete A, which was a very good documentary on Netflix regarding the gymnasts that survived the assaults from Larry Nassar. Highly recommend if you have not watched it. But Jennifer Say joined Mark back in August and discussed a couple of different things: how the business got started, where she affiliates now politically, and much more.
Mark Reardon on St. Louis's home for conservative talk.
Well, of course, we've had Riley Gaines on the show, and we had, well, look at even yesterday, Michelle Tafoya was on. You have a lot of heroes out there that are championing women's sports, and I think we have another one this afternoon. Jennifer Say, who is the founder and CEO of XXXY Athletics, is a USA champion gymnast, also produced an Emmy Award-winning documentary, Athlete A, on Netflix, is with us this afternoon. Jennifer Say, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy that you're here because I'm a fan. I've been following you just a little bit. Is it fair to say, I want to get some background information and get the politics straight. Sure. This is a conservative political talk radio show. However, are you a reformed liberal? Would you describe yourself as a reformed liberal or not?
I would. It's almost cliche at this point, but I would call myself politically homeless. I am definitely a disaffected liberal. I'm no longer a member of the Democrat Party, but I'm not a Republican either. So I don't know what that makes me.
Well, and you're not alone. I think there's a lot of people out there that feel like they're homeless. And, you know, folks who certainly, when you wrote a column, you weren't going to vote for Joe Biden. I think even in that column, you said you weren't going to vote for whoever the Democrat nominee is. But that doesn't automatically put you in the Trump camp, I guess, is what I'm hearing, right?
I mean, I guess there's a few things. So I have been, you know, I was a Democrat for as long as I could remember and could vote, you know, since I could register. I lived in San Francisco for 35 years, so that'll give you a sense of sort of where I felt at home. I always say I was a left of center Democrat. Like, I didn't vote for Gavin Newsom when he ran for mayor. I voted for the Green Party. So that just gives you a sense. But I don't like really how dogmatic either party is. So at this point, you know, I decided I was no longer a Democrat during COVID. I was appalled by the illiberalism of the Democratic Party during COVID. They wanted to lock down forever. They wanted to keep poor children out of school, keep people from worshiping, small business owners from, you know, running their businesses. They were censoring people for mis or disinformation. It felt... So, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really feel like I've abandoned my principles. I thought what the Democratic Party stood for was freedom of speech, standing up for the little guy. You can laugh at me and say they never did, but there was a time when the Democrats absolutely were the party of free speech. And they just abandoned every value that I held dear. They didn't care about children and what was happening to children. They didn't care about women being driven out of the workforce in droves. And so I just, you know, during COVID, I swore I would never be a member of the Democratic Party again. Does it mean I'll never vote for one? I don't know. Certainly not one that had anything to do with those COVID policies. Never going to vote for anyone that advocated for keeping schools shut during COVID. But I find the other side to be as dogmatic. It's like if you don't agree on every single thing, then you're a rhino.
Well, I don't like that either. Yeah, look, I get called a rhino because, you know, of some things that I've said in the past, and I don't play that game. And I get the political homelessness aspect of it. I really do because, and you know, I can just, not that you really care, but my story is I didn't think Trump had a chance in 2016 when I was looking at the electoral map. I was deadly wrong about that. I didn't vote for him. I thought he was reprehensible. I don't like the behavior. I did vote for him in 2020, and I'm going to vote for him now because I just think so much is on the line. That's my concern.
I completely understand that. And I'm, you know, I'm not saying I won't vote for him. I'm definitely not voting for Kamala. That I know. And I'm certainly, if we sort of transition to, you know, the business that I just started, I'm certainly not going to vote for any candidate that doesn't know what a woman is.
I know.
How can you protect women's rights if you can't even define what a woman is? So that, you know, I will prioritize you. No candidate, I think, will deliver on everything you want. You know, for me, COVID and the illiberalism during COVID, and I'll be honest, that's my hesitation with Trump. Is I don't think he was great during COVID either. I also don't think he'd ever do what he did again.
No, I agree with that.
Fauci has the mic. I don't think he'd advocate for any sort of lockdown ever again. But, you know, if you were for closed schools during COVID, you will never have my vote. And if you can't define what a woman is, you will never have my vote.
You know, and I wonder, one of the questions I've asked on the show, and I wish I could say with confidence that this might happen at least one time, that someone out there, whether it's George Stephanopoulos or someone else, will ask if they ever sit down and do a real interview, Kamala Harris or Tim Walz, if they can define a woman or how they feel about this issue that's important to so many people, including Democrats across the country, about women's sports.
Well, I mean, 70%, the latest Gallup poll, which is several months old, 70% of Americans said that they agree that women's sports needs to be protected, that the original meaning of Title IX needs to be protected. But I will tell you, as someone out there in the wild and in the wilderness advocating for this, it doesn't feel like 70% of Americans agree with me. I feel like I am very much in the minority because so many of that 70% are absolutely silent because they're afraid, because you get called every horrible name, you get dragged across the internet. And I actually think the number's higher than 70%. I think people are so afraid they won't even say it in an anonymous poll. That's how scared they are, because people's careers can be ruined. That said, part of the reason I wanted to start this brand, XX-XY Athletics, is to normalize something that should be normal, to stand up for women and girls and the protection of women's sports and spaces. Brands can do that now. You know, they can inform and influence the culture. Over the last 20 years, you know, I spent the last 30 years marketing very mainstream brands. Brand in the apparel space, brands have normalized ideas that we now kind of accept and embrace. Dove normalized body positivity, which I think has jumped the shark, but was really good for between about 2010 to 2018. And I think it was great that we now see women who aren't all, you know, 5'11 and 98 pounds in advertising. That was a very unhealthy, aspirational look. And so this notion that brands help normalize that. Nike helped normalize fitness and exercise. I mean, I've traveled around the world in my former role at Levi's, and, you know, Nike brought exercise to the masses in many countries where that wasn't a normal thing in the past. So I think brands have that ability along with art. And I think on this issue in particular, it is right coded as far as who supports our side,
right,
vocally and publicly, but we're tackling it from the policy and legislation standpoint. We're not tackling it further upstream from the culture, informing culture, ideas, et cetera. And I think we lose if we only try to tackle it from a legislation perspective. And I'm much better at influencing culture, so that's why I decided to start this brand.
So Jennifer says, you wrote a book, you mentioned Levi Strauss, you used to run Levi Strauss, you wrote a book called Levi's Unbuttoned, The Woke Mob Took My Job But Gave Me My Voice. We want people to read the book, but can you summarize what that book is about and kind of how you transitioned into the new company?
Yeah, I worked at Levi's for 23 years. I love the brand. I'm actually wearing it right now. I started there in 1999 as an entry-level marketing assistant and worked my way all the way up the ladder. I ended up as the chief marketing officer for 8 years, which is a very long time to hold that role, and the brand president for two. But I held all kinds of roles there. The book is really very, it's a bit of a salacious title, but it's very much about my career as a woman in corporate America and climbing that ladder and the challenges that I faced. And I think recognizing how far we've come, because I will tell you, in the 90s in corporate America, it was tough for women. There were no women in leadership. There were no mentors or role models. There were some unpleasant situations I found myself in. But it's gotten a lot better, and I wanted to sort of celebrate that also, that we sometimes fail to acknowledge the progress we've made. I think that's part of the problem with the Democratic Party right now is, you know, they would have you believe this country is more racist than it was in the 1920s. I mean, that's not true.
Well, it's not true. And even Barack Obama admitted evolution. But, you know, we just celebrated the 10th year of the anniversary of the destruction of the St. Louis region with Mike Brown, Jennifer. And that's when, you know, I would put my finger on that being ground zero, when race relations started turning exactly in the opposite direction after decades of improvement.
What was the moment in time that you said?
The Mike Brown, hands up, don't shoot, our Ferguson moment here in St. Louis. That was the 10-year anniversary.
Oh,
was a couple of weeks ago.
I see. Yes, I knew it was the 10-year anniversary. I think that's right. I think it did probably start then. And I think it then I mean, this is really recent history, but I think it just blew up and exploded and totally went backwards in the summer of 2020.
Yeah, with George Floyd, right? It piggybacked on everything that started here in St. Louis. So when it comes to saving women's sports, and you know, I'm guessing you have good relationships with Riley Gaines, and I had Michelle Tafoy on the show yesterday. I did not know, and I looked this up at Kirk Herbstreit, who's a pretty big voice on ESPN, finally kind of broke his silence and said, hey, I'm done with this stuff. I'm not going to keep my mouth shut. That has to be very encouraging because a lot of the mainstream folks have been unwilling to do that.
It is really encouraging. And I think, you know, I participated with Riley Gaines this summer on a bus tour across the nation, and sort of a whistle stop tour, rallies in various cities across the country. And it was incredibly politically diverse, the women that were on this bus doing the tour. Martina Navratilova was one of the speakers in Washington, D.C. on one of the final stops. And she is a well-known lefty and a self-avowed lefty. This is an issue. It shouldn't be coded right.
You're
right. It is, but it should not be.
I
it's
know.
Really about truth. And I think that's why it lights so many people up, because it's such an egregious violation of truth. For people, the activists, the gender ideologues, to look me in the eye and to say to me, trans women are women and you have to say that or you're a bigot and you want to commit trans genocide. No, that's a lie. Trans women are trans women, or as Jordan Peterson says, trans women are men. It's different. The bodies are different. Our physicality is different. Men are stronger. Men are faster. We need to protect women's sports and spaces. And I think so many people are just like, that's the line for me. I'm not going to say that lie.
And we have so many people here, you know, I have a lot of Democrats, Midwestern Democrats, that are sane. They're not like San Francisco, that wholeheartedly agree. By the way, I've made this point.
Yeah.
I've made this point a lot. And I even had another example in my personal life, a story that my wife told us yesterday about a friend who's gay. The older gays, they hate this stuff. They're not.
Oh,
they're right
so
in line
true.
With us on this. And they're certainly not all conservatives, but they can't stand this trans stuff.
Yeah. The LG and the B want to divorce
right.
the T, I think, at
yeah.
a certain point. And so I, you know, after I left Levi's, I didn't sort of finish the story there, but the book does cover some of it. But I was very outspoken against lockdowns and school closures in particular, and I ended up having to leave San Francisco. I left my city. I lost most of my friends, and I basically started over in Denver. That's where I live now, which you can argue is deep blue, but it's a much different kind of of blue than San Francisco is. And as I started to interview for jobs over the course of 2023, I realized I couldn't go back into corporate America. I was being asked questions like, will you apologize for what you've done, meaning advocated for open schools during COVID?
Yeah.
And I said, no, I won't apologize. I was right. And so I just realized I wouldn't be able to go back into corporate America without selling my soul. And so I had to dust myself off at 50-something years old and start something totally new. And I just realized there was a hole in the marketplace. All these athletic brands claim to champion women, and not one has weighed up in on this issue. And I don't mind saying controversial things, so I figured I would do it. So, yeah, started my own brand. We launched in March of this year, March 25th. So we're only really almost 5 months old.
And the website is xx-xyathletics.com. Is that right?
That is correct, but I'll give you a little trick that can be hard to remember. If you go to thetruthfits.com, it will take you there as well.
And I know a radio host would love to do like live endorsements for that brand. You should put someone in touch, Jennifer Say. You have an amazing experience here in St. Louis. You know, Riley Gaines, I asked her this question when I had her on a few months ago, and I'm just curious about your answer. The thing that's frustrating from watching this issue with, you know, we've had some pretty important things happen in St. Louis with Wash U and Jamie Reed, our whistleblower who came forward.
Yeah, Jamie's amazing.
Right, she is, and she's been a guest recently as well. But when I asked Riley, because it seems so patently unfair that biological men should compete with women, and some people don't want to disavow that. Well, why can't Leah Thomas or someone out there just admit the fairness issue? And she said, well, if they do that, then the whole house of cards collapses, right? Because then they admit that a woman who was a man, who is now a woman, is not a woman. I don't know.
It's
I think I confused
man.
That. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Still a man. Yes. There's something. Yes. It used to be many years ago. Everybody was there. It was a very small percentage of people. We accepted it. They were called, you know, transsexuals. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. Pride was, you know, rainbow flags on a t-shirt, and nobody cared. And now it's this insistence that trans women are women. There is no biological difference. We are the same. In order to, I guess, to normalize it and make it accepted, we can't say they're not the same. Trans women are trans women, and they are male-bodied, and they need to either compete in the male category or some different open category. The whole thing blows up, and that's what, you know, Riley is correct, and what bothers me about this is I feel like, one, it's a lie, and two, the lie that underpins this notion that trans women should be able to compete in women's sports is that there's no difference between men and women, which means, you know where this goes? No categories in sports. There's just one, and it's dominated by men. That's what happens at the end of this if we don't stop it now.
I'm with you. I think a lot of people. Yeah, I think a lot of people are with you right now, and I appreciate your messaging. I told you from the beginning here, I'm a fan. Jennifer Say, thank you so much for coming on here. We didn't even get to talk about, you know, because I haven't watched Athlete A, but you were heavily involved. You were as a producer. That was the Larry Nassar documentary, right? That was on Netflix.
It was. I mean, one thing I should mention is I was an elite gymnast as a young person, yeah. And I was the first person to speak out about abuse in the sport. My first book called Chalked Up, which came out in 2008, was about the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse in gymnastics.
Were you with Mary Lou Retton on that team?
I was in that era. She's a couple years older than me, which in gymnastics makes a difference. So, but when we were very young, we competed against each other. And then she retired before I really hit my stride.
Well, I love your story, and thanks again for coming on here, and keep spreading the message of hope, and vote for Trump. That's what I'd say.
All
right, Jen, thank you so much. I appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Take care. Betsy Gabbard, who's with us, the brand new book, For Love of Country, Leave the Democrat Party Behind. Congresswoman, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's kind of fun. I see the number. It comes up. It says mobile from Honolulu. I hope you're there right now. Does it just say that because your phone is from Hawaii? Are you there right now?
That's because my phone is from Hawaii. I've got the 808 area code. I'm calling you from the heart of New York City, the opposite of Hawaii.
I would say so. Now, my position would be if I am from Hawaii, I'd want to spend as much time there as possible. But let's kind of start in the moment in the news of the day. I was going to maybe get to this a little later, but just observations from the craziness right now on these college campuses. And I guess nothing should stun me about this administration, but the lack of willingness to weigh in here on all this nonsense that is not freedom of speech is really kind of stunning to me.
Yeah, Mark, you know, to me, it's even worse than not being willing to weigh in. To have the president of the United States silent at this time when you have these pro-Hamas protesters and college campuses across the country who are saying things like, we hope October 7th happens 10,000 times over, wishing death upon Jewish people, parroting Hamas's anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, anti-freedom mantras. This is a moment where our kids don't feel safe on their campuses, where their graduations are being threatened from not being able to take place at all. Classes are being canceled. Kids are being kept at home. To say that the peace is broken puts it lightly. And our president is completely missing in action. This is a reflection of weakness. It is a reflection of fear that President Biden appears to be so afraid of angering the pro-Hamas contingent of the Democrat elite, embodied by people like Representative Ilhan Omar and others, that instead of simply saying, we defend free speech and peace in this country, that we stand against anti-Semitism, and we stand against Hamas, a radical Islamist terrorist organization, and those who support them. It is not that hard to do. The fact that he is failing to do so, while President Trump has been unequivocal in making a similar statement himself, paints the picture of the contrast that we are looking at in this country today, as well as the contrast in the votes that people will take this November.
Well, let's talk about the book. Some of my favorite people these days are Reform Democrats, so you have that going for you. And, you know, I live in a part of the country where there are sane Democrats, Tulsi, as you might imagine. And I like that the book is called For Love of Country, because I will say this, and my audience knows this, and I think everything that we've been talking about goes to this point. One of my concerns is the future of the country. And I see these people on college campuses that simply, they don't love America. I don't even know why they want to be here based on their behavior. But one of the reasons that I've, and this gets nuanced a little bit, I wasn't a big fan and still not a big fan of Donald Trump's behavior, but I don't see another path to right the ship on some things that are very dangerous right now in this country. And I'm guessing that you kind of agree with that.
You know, you're exactly right. We have to look at what's going on in the country for what it is, where we are, and the facts. There's a lot of people who have different feelings and thoughts and wish that, gosh, I wish we had more options to consider as we head into this election. But the reality is that President Biden and his Vice President Kamala Harris, on domestic policy, on foreign policy, on the Constitution, on the rule of law, on border security, on national security, on our fundamental rights and freedoms enshrined in the Constitution, in every one of these areas, it's worse than failing. Their policies are acting directly against the interests of the American people, our freedom, our peace, and our security. They are undermining our very identity of who we are as a country and our foundational principles, and they must be stopped. Donald Trump is the person who's best positioned to be able to defeat President Biden. We as Americans need to recognize the necessity to stop them, the Democrat elite, from destroying our country, and find a way for us to come together. Not that we've got to agree on everything, not that you have to walk in lockstep with any individual or party, but come together around our fundamental principles: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, our right to take care of ourselves and our family and raise our kids in a peaceful and prosperous society. These are things that we need to take a stand for now. If the Biden-Harris administration is allowed to stay in power, my deep fear and concern is that all that we are seeing has been done over these last 3.5 years will not only continue, it will get exponentially worse, and the freedoms that we will lose will be virtually impossible to get back.
Was there a moment for you? Look, I've seen the evolution with a lot of people out there. Bill Maher, of course, comes to mind. I don't know if you know. Do you know who Sasha Stone is by any chance, Congresswoman?
I don't.
So Sasha Stone is, I talk about her. Nobody really knows who she is. She runs a website called awardsdaily.com. She's in Hollywood. She was so crazy that I never defriend people on Facebook, but she was so nuts in the aftermath of Bush and some of this stuff. But she's done, now she was a crazy lefty. You were never a crazy lefty. I remember seeing you when you were running for president. But she's done such a dramatic turnaround, and along the lines of Matt Taibbi, you know, so some of this stuff has really caught the attention of some folks on the left to say, wait a second, this is really dangerous. And then you can go to the media and what Yuri Berliner said and all that from a couple of weeks ago. Those are things that I certainly care about, because the media is so dishonest with so many of these things.
That's right. And there are so many people across the country who are seeing what's going on and going through that, you know. I hesitate to call it an evolution, because really it's the Democrat Party that's gone insane. It is a party that is unrecognizable from the party that I joined over 20 years ago, which is one of the main reasons why I left. It's a matter of us all as Americans kind of being that innocent little child that says, hey, the emperor has no clothes on, calling them out for the crazy policies, the destructive policies that they're propagating, and knowing that we're the only ones who can do something about this. We're the only ones that can stop them. So if for no other reason, taking on that individual responsibility that we have as citizens and the mandate that our founders gave to us, when in our founding documents they said that our government only exists with the consent of the governed, and that we, the people, are the ones, the only ones who can ensure that our government is of, by, and for the people. We have to make that happen now. We cannot afford to get to a place where our freedoms will be further undermined, and we won't be able to recognize this country that we love anymore.
Yeah, and I would put this Title IX situation into that category. Look, I love the fact that you use the KBJ bite that is in your video. I use that bite at the beginning of my show on many days, where she says, and she's unable to, you know, give the definition of a woman. I have a little 9-year-old little girl who's a swimmer. I'm very concerned about her future and some of the things being possibly taken away from her. I think a lot of us, again, going back to my comment from earlier, that there are sane even Democrats here in the middle part of the country, in the flyover states. I even have, you know, gay friends. Older gay friends that are just as outraged on some of this stuff, whether it's Title IX or the trans culture war stuff, as I am, Tulsi.
Yes, this is true. I am in the same boat. Gay and lesbian friends who are saying, hey, we don't want to have anything to do with this radical trans ideology movement that hey, if you're an adult and you make certain choices about who you are and how you want to live your life, that's completely up to you. This is a free country. But the fact that they are targeting the most vulnerable among us with our kids, like your daughter, President Biden's complete destruction of Title IX, taking away that level playing field and that equal opportunity that was the genesis behind Title IX, recognizing the difference, the biological differences between males and females, it defies objective truth. And anyone who is common sense minded and is willing to see it understands the implications of not only posing a risk. If you're talking about, you know, I grew up doing martial arts, and you can see the actual risk to safety in some of these examples. But taking away those opportunities for kids like your daughter who may want to pursue a scholarship as a swimmer, as an athlete, and others. This decision has such far-reaching consequences that I think are difficult to fully grasp in this moment. And frankly, that's why I wrote my book, Mark, is because there are so many other people who may still call themselves Democrats, but who see the problems as they are and see these policies being as destructive as they are. I share my own experiences of having walked this path myself. And I hope to be able to encourage others who feel the same way to know that you're not going against your principles for taking a stand for truth. And once again, however people may feel about Donald Trump or his style or different issues that you may disagree on, ultimately, if we lose our freedom as a society, as individuals in this country, which is under threat today, we will no longer be able to have debate. We will no longer be able to have a thriving open marketplace of ideas. This very core of our identity is what's at risk, and that's what we've got to save.
Well stated, Tulsi Gabbard. The book is called For Love of Country, Leave the Democrat Party Behind. It is out. And first of all, I want to say this before I let you go. Happy late birthday. I was on April 13th. I noticed on the Wikipedia that yours was on April 12th. So we wish you a happy late birthday. And then I got
to
get
birthday.
This in here, though. You know, there's some rumors out there that maybe Trump might be looking at you for Veep. Any comment on that?
I have heard the rumors.
I had to ask.
Well, we know that the vice president now is going to be J.D. Vance, but great getting to have on Tulsi Gabbard earlier in the year. That concludes our best of segments. Thank you so much for tuning in these last couple of days. A happy new year to you, Sue.
Hey, to you too, Ethan.
And we look forward to seeing you guys in 2025. Thanks for tuning in all year long to The Mark Rudin Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.